Welcome to the Ortho Joe Show, a joint production of the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery and Ortho Evidence. In our world, orthopedic research is king, and current topics from our respective publications are analyzed weekly. Here is Mohit Bhandari from Ortho Evidence and Mark Swinkowski from the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery.
Well, good morning, Mo. I'm coming to you from the conference room at JBJS headquarters on 20 Pickering here in Needham, Massachusetts. It's a building where I believe we've been since about 1992. It's a nice conference room. And thanks to some improvement in the pandemic, we're seeing more people back in the office. So it's all a good thing. But it's, we've had a horrible spring in Minnesota. Just horrible. I don't know if it's any better in Hamilton, but it was like snowing here last night.
That's right.
So, I mean, this is terrible. So I've got my Ortho Joe mug to just keep my hands warm, shivering coming in from the car. So, well, it's been a while since we did a taping, and I know that you've had this guidelines thing on your mind for a while. Let's chat about guidelines. You want to talk about the OA of the knee.
That's right. And just to make you feel somewhat the same as I have, I woke up this morning as well to snow, but that didn't stop me from putting my short sleeve shirt on because it's a balmy 1 degree Celsius in Canada, and that's shorts and totally short. And you'll see people lawn mowing today, when they're shorts, shirtless even. Canadians like that. They when it gets to zero, that's our summer. So we're pretty excited by the change in weather.
But I noticed you're not taping from outside though.
No. Not quite yet, but we should do one of those. I think you've just given me an idea. So I know for many of the listeners, a knee OA is a big part of their practice. I know we've got many, many surgeons who are managing patients, whether it's operatively, and certainly a lot of non-operative treatments as well. And the American Academy came out with a guideline in 2013 that had led to some, pretty significant changes in practice and how things were funded. And long-awaited, I think it's about 8 years, and we can talk a little bit about how often guidelines should be, updated. But after 8 years, a lot of work, in August of 2021, Mark, there was the Management of Osteoarthritis of the Knee Non-Arthroplasty revised guideline that did come out. And in this particular one, they had updates on 19 of the 29 different recommendations. Now, my plan isn't really to go through all of that, but I did want to make sure that we at least highlight some of these for one reason only, that even though this has come out last summer and we're approaching 2022 summer, the reality is, knowledge translation often takes lag. So the more we can get the messaging out, I think the better. And I would encourage readers to take a look at the JBJS literature that's looked at some of these, and I'll highlight some of that. And I'd also like to urge them to take a look at the guideline itself. It's freely available, and it's got lots and lots of data. It's a very big, big document, several hundred pages. So I think maybe a summary is warranted for us today, and maybe we'll be able to attract some discussion around that.
Yeah, just for people who are listening, tell me if I've got this right. The big controversy with the 2013 was the issue of downgrading the strength of evidence in favor of viscosupplementation. Do I have that right?
It was downgrading the evidence against the use of viscosupplementation. And so it was basically saying that there really is no strong evidence against the use of hyaluronic acid, really. And that was led to a fairly significant back and forth. I think we saw quite a bit of fragmenting of the American Academy's, different subgroups, you could say. The Arthroscopy Association North America was pretty strongly against some of those recommendations, and there have been lots of discussion around that. But you're right, there was that. There was also the promise of PRP in that, right? So right. PRP came out looking better than HA in that. And so there's lots of those sort of discussions. Corticosteroids came out looking very well. And you'll hear some of the changes actually that are quite interesting, at least at a high level, because I do think it has impact on day-to-day practice.
Okay.
So there aren't that many things in which they said there's strong evidence in favor. And it's the usual stuff. So, oral NSAIDs, topical NSAIDs, and even, limited doses of acetaminophen, all given the big, multi-star strong evidence in favor of use it. Exercise, strong evidence in favor of. and patient education, strong evidence in favor of. So nothing really particularly new with respect to those. Moderate evidence favoring braces, moderate evidence favoring patients losing weight. So that's kind of where, you know, I don't think anyone listening would say, okay, well, fair enough. That's interesting. Again, strong evidence against the use of insoles. So I don't think that's novel or new to anybody. And strong evidence against the use of opioids. And that would make a lot of sense. You know, there are concerns around the addiction and also the complications associated with that. So where do we get to the interesting part? Well, the interesting part always for, I think, practitioners has been, you know, the injectable landscape. So what's happening with corticosteroids? What's happening with PRP, which has been the most popular of the bunch, or at least moving up in that direction? And then also, you know, did they make any shift in the viscosupplementation? And that was it. If you'll allow me, just for sake of brevity, I'm going to share a slide. So basically, this is a paper that was published in JBJS Reviews in 2018. And I encourage again, and we'll put that link down for everyone. But what it does is it kind of shows all of the different treatments that are available from left to right. And I've highlighted a couple. There's a horizontal red dotted line, Mark, that really is the minimal clinically important difference. So you're looking for things to kind of cross that line as it goes upward, because it meant that they had a big enough difference that would likely matter. And again, we chose a very, very conservative estimate. So there are others who have used, you know, lower lines, but, you know, we took the highest possible threshold you'd have. So let's look at PRP, for example. In this particular update of the American Academy, which is 2021, they said here the following, and I'll quote them. They said, due to heterogeneity of results and the difference in early and late stage OA results with PRP, we downgraded the recommendation from strong in their previous guideline to limited. So they went down two full marks. So if anything, the more literature on PRP, largely small and very, very disparate, has led to actually a downgrading of the quality of evidence. And if you look at the data we had shown in the JBJS reviews, if you look at this, you see this, you know, like the overall effect, I mean, the average effect of that bar is pretty high. So PRP seems to work on average. However, the killer, unfortunately, is the variability. That's that, you know, confidence interval line that shows anything from no effect at all, where the controls are better than PRP, which in this case could be a saline or a placebo, all the way up to having big effects. So the challenge that I think that PRP faces is we need more data to understand in whom it works and in whom it doesn't. And ultimately, we need more information. American Academy has signaled that loud and clear with a significant downgrading of that evidence. The next one is...
Well, I don't want to interrupt your train of thought here, one of the big issues with PRP is the lack of reporting detail of what the manufacturing process is, what the handling of the samples are, and how what's in the actual injection that's delivered. And Tom Bauer wrote an excellent editorial for us about really needing standardization of reporting as to how the specimens are prepared, what's actually in them, before we can make progress in this field.
Well, and I think you're right. And if you look at that, it really, I mean, pretty clearly, and this is, remember, and the paper from that we're showing is from 2018. Now, I'm sure the JBJS paper had, you know, at least reflects what we're seeing in the 2021 update of the guidelines. I'm not saying they necessarily used all this data, but I'm sure they came up with their own analysis. But the truth is the data is the data. And it confirms that we have much more work to do. Though the promise is there, but I think there's a lot more work to do. That, and with the issue with corticosteroids, you know, again, they had moderate evidence and they made the caveat of short-term relief. So it isn't just use corticosteroids, you know, every 3 months for periods of years. It is meant to provide short-term relief, which is typically, as the American Academy suggested, under the 12-week period. So they said they also downgraded it one level because of potential risk in accelerating osteoarthritis from injections. I believe, Mark, although they didn't articulate it that way, that the paper that came out in JAMA by McAlinden and his group that looked at that, that looked at giving corticosteroids every 3 months for 2 years, and then showing that the MRI suggested some fibrillations and some changes, was one of the concerns with long-term use. So I don't think anyone's arguing, if you look at the blue there, that corticosteroids don't have an impact. In fact, the impact is, you know, reasonable. It's certainly one that has an effect. The challenge is you just don't use it for long-term effect. So that's kind of where the American Academy is set on that. But again, it was a downgrade from the 2013. So the last but not least is the moderate evidence. And again, for HA, so once again, overall, so here's the point. For HA, overall, they have basically shifted it once from a strong to moderate. So now they're saying it's not strong evidence that it doesn't work overall. They're saying it's moderate evidence that it doesn't work overall. But here's the caveat. If you look at the two yellow, they group them both together. So they're saying all HA. When you group it together, it doesn't work. The American Academy makes a very specific, and I think it's important to the readers to at least be aware of this for some of those who felt that they wanted to be using, you know, various injectables in their practice. They said here, and I'll quote, the 2013 edition of the guidelines strongly recommended against the use of viscosupplementation. Supplementation. In contrast to this updated version, the 2021 version found that statistically significant improvements were associated with high molecular weight and cross-linked hyaluronic acid. The group felt that a specific subset of patients might benefit from its use. So you can see the American Academy, and very similar actually to this paper in JBS Reviews, looked at breaking them up. And when you break them up, you make a very clear distinction that low molecular weight HA doesn't seem to work in the same capacity as the higher molecular weight, which in fact, many ways has effects that are looking on average like the PRP with a much narrower confidence interval, so a bit more precision. So the thing with PRP that I think needs to do, hopefully in the next iteration, is to do the same, Mark, is to find out what elements and what processing and, you know, and try to standardize it in a way that it's been done in others, because the average effect of PRP is problematic, but I don't think there is an average effect that we should be using. We should try to construct through literature and evidence and processing and standardization what works and what doesn't. So I'll stop there just for sake of time. But I did think it was an important, it was an important update, and one that, you know, guidelines often will come, you know, can come through, but these were some fairly important downgrades and some important upgrades that were made.
Right. Yeah, well, that brings us back to the issue that you and I have really been all about, the quality of evidence, for our entire careers. And what is the essential issue with guidelines? It's really just one point in time. And nearly by the time it's published, there's been more information that's published, right? So it's trying to nail a point in time when the field is continuing to move on a month by month, if not sooner, basis. Right?
Absolutely.
How are we going to address this? What's OE's plan to address this?
Yeah, that's a great point. I think, you know, we're starting to see in many places the word living, like living meta-analysis, Mark, living network meta-analysis, or living guideline, which is what they mean is, rather than have a situation where you make this now fact for the next several years until the group comes back and looks at the data over a five-year period, as new information comes in, the living document is updated. So you're starting to see a much more rapid, you know, uptake of information. And that is what we're starting to see with the term living, meaning that there isn't static. So it's dated by the moment it is, but tomorrow it could change. The hard part of that is resource and, you know, and the ability to have the team to be able to do that. But I do believe ultimately people are going to want up-to-date information. They're not going to look at a guideline becomes stale probably within the first 24 months. I mean, that's the best case scenario that it could last, right? I mean, if you look at the American Academy, one might argue that right at 2014-15, there was papers coming out that were completely changing the narrative. And, you know, it's 2021. So, you know, that's a fairly big time gap between, you know, updates.
Yeah, I don't know the exact number for the number of manuscripts that have been published on PRP clinical studies, but I'm sure it's in the hundreds.
I'd say it's several hundreds by now. I remember back in 2012, there were 100 and some odd, north of 100 RCTs. But remember, the sample size averaging from 8 patients to 200 right. patients. I mean, not, you know, and also they were just exploring. I mean, every indication, so many different indications being done. And the hardest thing, right, that I've learned is it's so hard that once it's very easy to destroy a brand quickly, whatever you're doing, whatever you're like, you know, because you get excited by it. But once it's gone down, to rebuild it is a very hard journey. And you've got to, and the only way you rebuild it is by building it with trust. And trust comes from high quality data.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. In general, I think it, that whole concept applies to large organizations too. What I've said, and I'm not sure where I heard it, but 7 years to build up a brand, it takes less than one to tear it down. I think it's true in this field as well.
Yeah, you made the point exactly. I mean, the American Academy's guidelines are very powerful, you know, and in one statement, it took several years to rebuild some of these. Now, you can argue that it was needed and we needed to have a bit of a shakeup because, you know, I think you need to have that. But you're right. You need good quality evidence. And you also need good quality synthesis of evidence, because if the information is there, Mark, you know, it's our jobs in many ways, all of us, to be thinking, OK, what's the noise? And what's the noise? Get rid of it and keep the signal.
Well, we'll keep working towards that living document future, which is, I think, where the field needs to go. So, well, I hope that the spring lasts longer than a week in Hamilton. That's what we're training for in Minnesota. I did see some blossoms on the trees here in Massachusetts, so we're hopeful.
Excellent. Excellent.
Have a great day. And
all right. Cheers. Take care.
Bye.